I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and Mario Loyola, who writes for the conservative magazine The National Review and works with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, a conservative think tank. Take it away, Jimmy. Too bad there's nothing to talk about, right?
Right. Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas. Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
Doing good, man.
Get all right. Hey, my man. Good to see you back. Well, let's get things started. While Congress fights over the federal dollars and the ever-expanding debt, many people of color are asking, well, what money? I mean, a new report says that while the recession hit everyone hard, it was African-Americans and Latinos that really took it in the mouth. Michelle, really?
Yeah, so, you know, we started talking about this with Congressman Emanuel Cleaver a few minutes ago, but let me just expand on this. And we'll link to this report on our website if people want to check it out for themselves. The Pew Research Center used census information to confirm just how wide the wealth gap between whites and minorities is. It turns out that between 2005 and 2009, the median net worth of Latino households dropped by 66%. It dropped by 53% for African-Americans. And it dropped by 16% for whites. And one reason that the report cited for this disparity is that minorities tend to have more money wrapped up in housing, which is a point that Congressman Cleaver made, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. You know, one of the things that the research doesn't tell us, which I think is important to note, that many of these households of color are single family, which means single earner. And to me, that kind of makes the numbers kind of hanky going in, but I still think it's noteworthy. Ruben, you're first. Get this. The median net worth of white households is now about 113 grand. For Latino households, it's about 6 grand. And for African Americans, it's 5 grand, unless you live in my house, which, you know, maybe not. But sad, there are sad numbers there. Yeah. So, I mean, Ruben, your first in.
Well, listen, you know, there's another – well, I'll tell you what. There's another little part to this story, and that is the Asian numbers were a bit of a surprise to me. They are actually higher than the African American numbers, 54% of Asians, as I recall. It was a 54% drop for Asians, 66% for Latinos, as Michelle said. So that's sort of the way it went. It was Latinos got it the worst, then Asians, then African Americans. And then obviously there was this not so bad a hit for white folks at 16% of their decline, their net worth over that time period. This is significant for a couple of reasons. How many times have we heard on this show and talked about on this show the perception that minorities are getting away with all this good stuff? We have actually heard from individually, I'm sure, readers and listeners out there, white males in their 20s and 30s who think, man, it's too bad I wasn't born black because I could get into the college I wanted to.
Right.
I could have affirmative action.
Among other reasons, right.
I could get these freebies. I could get all this free stuff from the government, you know. And there is a perception out there we laugh about sometimes. There's a perception, particularly among young people, that somehow minorities have it great. And this is the wake-up call. So raise your hand out there, folks. If you still want to be one of us, you know, let us know because these numbers don't look so good. You know, there's room in the boat with a hole in the bottom if you want to come in. I think that there is a significance to that in that regard. Beyond that, though, it's just bad news for the country because guess what, Jimmy? The country is becoming more like us. As the country becomes more non-white, what does it mean that you have such a decline in wealth among that population? This is no fringe part of the population. This is a major piece of the pie.
Well, let's hear from everybody on this.
A-Train.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Ruben. You know, talking about 113,000 for white Americans, 6,000 for Latinos, 5,000 for African Americans.
Just to remind people, he's talking about net worth.
Median net worth, which means
half have more and half have less than that.
Yeah,
so think about
and
that.
And for me, you know, the only 100 grand that I have in my apartment is a chocolate bar. So, you know, this is something that a lot of Americans are dealing with today. You know, what I found most interesting about the study was the whole housing equity, you know, debate in terms of, you know, how minority Americans tend to have more of their total net worth tied into their home equity as opposed to white Americans who tend to have more diversified portfolios. And I think that if there is sort of a silver lining to be taken from this, you know, for people of color around the country, it's to diversify your portfolios as much as you can. Obviously, you know, a lot of people want to buy single family homes for the first time. I'm still renting to this day. And so I know a lot of my net worth will end up being tied up in a house as well. But, you know, I think that the more we diversify our portfolios, you know, the less effect a housing crash is going to have on future Americans.
What about Mario? Where are you on this, Mario?
There's something screwy about these numbers because I know that the overall American household sector is leveraged to about 90% is the ratio of debt to assets of the American household sector when looking at the economy as a whole. So I don't know. I mean, where these people are, I mean, half of whites have a net worth greater than 130,000.
Why wouldn't that be the case if you've got intergenerational transfers of wealth? Why wouldn't you? If you've got parents who had a house and you had grandparents who had a house and they give you that house. I mean, you've never seen this in your own life, Mario?
I mean,
you don't have friends that you went to college with and, you know, their parents are like, oh, you're getting married. Do you want a house or do you want a big wedding? You've never seen that?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I just thought that the American household in general was a lot more indebted than these numbers suggest. I mean, but another thing to think about, that's just a general observation, but another thing to think about is, you know, these numbers from back in 2005 before the housing bubble burst, it's really important to realize that there was a policy in the 90s of trying to extend housing ownership opportunities to Latinos and African Americans, to underserved and minority populations. And that was a big part of the reason why we had a housing bubble, is that we were extending mortgages to people who couldn't really afford them. So these valuations in 2005, the housing valuations in 2005, we know now that those houses were overvalued.
You know, this is such an interesting question, Mary. I'm glad you brought it, because we're actually going to dig deeper into this in the coming weeks. And, you know, perhaps you can come back and talk to us more about that. Because the other point that's worth making, and I credit your point in this, there's been some interesting research on this. The other point that bears mentioning is that the federal government previously played a role in discriminating against minorities, particularly African Americans, as a matter of law. The Federal Housing Administration, for example, was among those that supported restrictive covenants that did not allow people to lend in neighborhoods to African Americans. So they had an active role in suppressing the wealth accumulation of particular groups.
Right.
And so you could make an argument.
And they overcorrected.
That's the argument. Jimmy, what do you think before we move on?
Well, like I said, I think that the numbers are kind of hinky, because a lot of these households we're looking at just have a single earner. They're single parent. They're headed by the single mom or just one person. So I don't know. The numbers are hinky.
What are you saying? Are you saying that the real issue here is the marriage rates? Because Latinos get married, and so do Asians. I mean, black people get married too. I mean, I'm married, you know, you're married. But I'm just saying, in terms of the marriage rates and the prevalence of marriage, Latinos and Asian and Americans tend to have higher marriage rates. So why would their loss of net worth be as sharp?
Well, I don't know, because maybe you have a wife that's employed and a husband that's not. But the other thing I'm getting at is I think that very often, you know, people of color, and this is kind of an aside, but people of color are always the last people hired and first people fired.
Oh,
so,
thank you.
It doesn't surprise me.
You said
that, that these are the people that are broke. You know, so yeah. I mean, you mean really? So
preach, brother.
You're the last person hired. You're the first person fired, and you're broke. Color me surprised, right?
Right. And that happens. Jimmy's makes a very important point. Understand this. This happens at all the way up the food chain. Sure. You can talk a lot about how it hurt folks at the lower levels, but you can have white collar professional jobs in a lot of different industries, whether it be law, investment banking, the media, whatever, and that same rule applies, because at the end of the day, it's every man for himself, and it won't surprise any folks to know that sometimes you end up with editorial boards and newspapers in this country that are all white. They didn't start out that way, but when they started laying off the folks, somehow, miraculously, the only people left over were the white folks. It's amazing. Imagine the odds.
I just want to stand up for the fact that I think there's a lot of fun things about it being a person of color. I just want to point that out. I just want to the whole picture to be completely dire.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't want to start giving specific details about
the
things.
Right.
There's a lot of good things, too. I just wanted to balance that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to our weekly barbershop segment. We're joined by author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney, and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, columnists Mario Loyola, and syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, switching gears to the deporter-in-chief. That's
Cole.
What some Latinos are calling
so
President
Cole.
Obama. I know, right?
Yeah. Jimmy's
his popularity. It plunged with many of them since deportations rose under his presidency. Now, on Monday, he spoke at the National Council of La Raza conference in Washington. We got some tape, right?
I think we do. Yeah, of course, La Raza, for people who aren't aware, is the largest Latino civil rights organization in the country. And the president got huge support at their meeting in 2008. But this year, the reaction was mixed, and he got some I don't know. You can hear for yourselves. Let me just play. He's talking here about the fact that he says that people think he can wave a magic wand and address immigration on his own, and he says he can't. And I'll just play a short clip.
Right now, dealing with Congress, the idea... But believe me, the idea of doing things on my own is very tempting. I promise you, not just on immigration reform. But that's not how our system works. That's not how our democracy functions.
And if I don't know if you heard that last person, the person was saying, change it. So, right. I don't know. Ruben, you weren't
so
there.
Wow.
We have, of course, had Janet Murguia, the CEO of Lodassa, on the program. She talked a little bit about this.
Right.
But I don't know. Ruben, you actually wrote a tough column. Big shock
about
this.
Two tough columns. One for the syndicate before he spoke, before the president spoke, and one after he spoke, talking, particularly paying a lot of cred to these students who were in the room, who were wearing these bright red shirts that said, Obama deports dreamers, the reference to young kids who might be eligible for the Dream Act, which would allow college-age kids to get legal status if they went to college or joined the military. So these are really bold folks and young kids out there who just – maybe they don't understand politics or maybe they understand it too well because they just think that President Obama can do more on this issue than he's doing. Here are the main complaints, basically. You have 1 million people who've been deported, about 1 million people plus 26,000 who've been deported since Obama took office. More people deported than any president since Dwight D. Eisenhower. And that goes all the way back to a program in like 1954 called Operation Wetback. Mm. That was the name of the program. And it moved out a bunch of folks. Now, you have to go all the way back to Ike to get a number similar to Obama's number. The other problem is you have seen in the past presidents use executive power, whether it was Bill Clinton, who said recently that if he were president, he would raise the debt limit, you know, just by fiat, by executive power. You have the expansion of executive power under George Bush in sort of the anti-terror policies and the stuff that happened after 9/11. A lot of liberals wanted from Obama, not just Latinos, but liberals in general wanted from Obama sort of a liberal version of Bush to go and use executive power this way, right, toward left-leaning causes. He hasn't done that. He has actually shrunk the presidency, and he doesn't like using executive power at all for any issue, even when the left wants him to. And the last word on this is Latinos have seen their support for Obama drop off. You know, two-thirds of them voted for him. The concern now at the White House is not that they're going to go out and vote for Republicans, because those people are ghastly in many cases toward Latinos and immigration issues. But they could just stay home. And if they stay home, they hurt the president. So the president's a little worried about this. I had a killer line, if I got to say so myself. It got me a lot of heat. I got me a lot of heat in the CNN column. I said, basically, what you have here, this is a black president. This is the color scheme. A black president trying to reassure white voters by removing all the brown folks. Ba-dum-bum.
That's harsh.
Wow.
Mario,
that is tough.
Mario, what do you think?
As my brother says, it's hard, but it's fair.
I mean, from a conservative's point of view, it's, you know, I'm not one of those people who there's lots of conservatives, obviously, who say Obama's a liar and stuff, just like, you know, liberals said of Bush during the Bush presidency. I don't think that he is dishonest from our point of view, because he's arguing with us and he's engaged with us. But it's really remarkable when I hear Obama talking to his base voters, how misleading he is to them. I mean, that's something that, you know, he
what misleading
he really.
Misleading,
well,
how?
For example,
give an example.
In that same speech, you know, he says, my number one priority every single day is to figure out how we can get businesses to hire and create jobs with decent wages. But in reality, you know, he's proposing to tax the very people who are going to create those jobs. The Environmental Protection Agency is adopting one rule after another that is throwing thousands of people out of work. It's going to cost the economy hundreds of billions of dollars. Just a single rule out of the 32 rules that are coming into effect over the next 2 years is going to cost the American economy tens of billions of dollars with totally speculative environmental benefits. The moratorium last year, the various moratorium and permitoriums on the Gulf Coast threw something like 20,000 people out.
Okay,
of work.
That's one point of view about the role that regulation plays. I mean, Arsalan, I think you probably have a different view of that.
Well, I mean, it's just,
and also what creates jobs. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, okay. President Obama just can't catch a break. I mean, you know, whether you're talking from the right or from the left, you know, he is a president who has dedicated the first term of his presidency to try and lead by consensus. And I think that the obstructionist wing of the Republican Party has essentially said no to everything. And so, you know, there is a reason that there's no political will for comprehensive immigration reform, because all of the White House and even Democratic congressional leaders know that it's never going to get out. And so hopefully when we see Barack reelected, then we might see a little more forcefulness coming
who
out.
Who laughed? Who just laughed? Somebody laughed.
Jimmy. I laugh.
Go ahead,
I laugh.
Jimmy.
You know, it's
Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive.
Yeah, I know, right?
Somebody's
got
to, man.
Obama supporters are so disappointed. First, he couldn't turn water to wine. Now he can't, you know, wave a magic wand. Next thing you'll tell me, he can't fly.
We'll take Gatorade instead of wine right now.
Come on, man.
Before we let you go, Arsene, I have to ask you about the trades. The big, finally, the NFL and the players
Tristan
made up. They came to an agreement on the collective bargaining agreement. There are still some details to be worked out on, you know, health and safety issues and so forth like that. But training camp open.
Training camp and free,
lots of big trades.
And free agency. Are you ready for some football? Because we've been waiting for this. So, you know, the big trades were Reggie Bush from the New Orleans Saints to the Miami Dolphins, Albert Haynesworth from the Redskins to the Patriots, Donovan McNabb, now a Minnesota Viking, Kevin Cobb, quarterback, goes to the Arizona Cardinals, and then Sidney Rice and Tavares Jackson move from Minnesota to Seattle. So we're going to see a lot of old faces in new places this year.
And you forgot the Steelers trading Antoine Randle-L after he helped them win, what, two Super Bowls, three? I mean, what's up with that? What's up with that?
They have a solid wide receiver core. And so, you know, they're probably going to try to fill some gaps in some other places.
Jimmy, do you care?
Well, you know, I care about the Browns, you know, because it looks like a good hungry team right out the gate. But I'm hoping that they can recruit either Bruce Wayne or Tony Stark after losing Eric Wright to the Detroit Lions. But, you know, when it comes to Browns football, you live in Cleveland long enough, you know, you'll get your heart broken if you get excited too soon. So you kind of take a wait and see attitude.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm hopeful.
You're trying to keep it chill.
Right.
All right. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and author of the book The Denzel Principle. He joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group, Latino Magazine, and Pajamas Media. He was with us from San Diego. Mario Loyola is director of the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a think tank focused on the impact of federal policies on states. He's also a former speechwriter at the Pentagon and a columnist for the National Review. He was with us from member station KUT in Austin. And Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of themuslimguide.com, and managing editor of the Crescent Post. He was here in Washington, D.C. Thanks, guys.
Peace.
Thank you.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.